And love lost, as painful as it is, if you just sit with it very quietly, you can sense something of God's sustaining presence guiding you through the loss.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Today we're going to talk about mystical experience. So have you had a mystical experience? In the Christian tradition, there is a name, Emmanuel, that means God with us. And as we'll hear from our guest, James Finley, a mystical experience is just that, you experiencing the presence of God, which could happen when you're alone or in family or even a larger group. So back to my question, have you had a mystical experience? If you asked me that before this interview, I would have said, yes, maybe two or three, I think. But after speaking with James Finley and his expansive understanding of what that kind of experience could be, I think I could add to that list. Maybe you'll add to your list, too. James Finley is faculty at the Center for Action and Contemplation, and at one time resided at Gethsemane Monastery in Kentucky, where he was mentored by contemplative monastic priest and author Father Thomas Merton. Finley earned his PhD in clinical psychology and primarily works with people suffering from the long-term effects of internalized trauma and how contemplative prayer can increase their quality of life. He's written numerous books, most recently his memoir, The Healing Path, in 2022, and he currently hosts the podcast Turning to the Mystics. James Finley will be presenting on mysticism at the Faith and Science Conference in Rome, Italy, in June of 2025. Check out the conference schedule at faithandscience.eu.
When I was in the ninth grade, I was 14 years old. There was a lot of trauma going on at home. My mother was a devout Catholic, and I knew her faith had sustained her through the violence. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school in Akron, and one of the Holy Cross brothers there teaching in the religion class talked about monasteries. I'd never heard of monasteries before. And the way I recall it, he spoke of monasteries as places where people go to seek and to find and give themselves to God, who's wholly poured out and given to us in each passing moment of our life. And they believe that their hidden life of fidelity to that search touches the whole world in ways we don't understand. And he mentioned Thomas Merton. I'd never heard of Thomas Merton. And the impact that he had. And when he went to the monastery, he wrote his memoir, Seven Story Mountain. So I went to the school library that night, that day after school. They had one book by him, The Sign of Jonas, which is a journal that he wrote. And on the very first page, he says, as for me, I have but one desire, the desire for solitude, to disappear into the secret of God's face. And at 14, I didn't know what it meant. Mm-hmm. But something in me said, me too. That is, the depth from which he spoke of his own longing for God awakened that depth in me. And for the next 4 years, I read that book over and over, and I lived there in this cloistered monastery for almost 6 years. It had a profound effect on me. And then Merton, as a novice master, guided me in the search, and he led me into the classical texts of the mystics. I was so radicalized by that, this sense of communion, this deep experience of incarnate infinity intimately realized, like the divinity of standing up and sitting down, and how reflective prayer becomes words of wordless silence and oneness and so on. So when I left the monastery, I still wanted to live that way, my meditation practice and the mystics. And so I wrote a book, Merton's Palace of Nowhere, on ultimate identity. I was a high school religion teacher at the time, was married, had two children. And I started giving silent meditation retreats around the United States and Canada and several times in Europe. The retreats were in silent. The meals were in silent. There were three sits a day, 20 minutes, each sitting in silence together. Then I would speak from my heart from a mystical text and see how it sheds light on the depth dimension of their day-by-day life at home.
When people come to the retreat, do they say what they're seeking? Some may be saying healing, or some that they want to have a personal experience with God maybe they haven't had, or maybe they have?
I'll share something with you that meant a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I also had a chance to study medieval philosophy under Daniel Walsh, who taught philosophy at Columbia. And I was very affected by the philosophical theology of the Middle Ages and so on. So when I was writing Merton's Palace of Nowhere on the Trousseau, I said, I don't know how to communicate this to people out here. that we subsist in God like light subsists in flame, the oneness. And he wrote back, he said, you can't communicate it, but it will communicate itself through you if you're convinced in what you say.
Interesting.
Yeah, and he says, if you are what you say, and you know it'll communicate itself because there'll be a response in the listener that knows something very deep inside of them that matters very much is being awakened. I think that's what I do. I think I try to speak from my heart about this oneness. I try to help people look for little moments where they had a glimpse of it in the midst of nature, the arms of the beloved, or reading a child a good night story, or lying in the dark, listening to your breathing, like it washes over you, like a taste of it. And how in that taste, that you get the intuition that in these awakening moments, you don't get the intuition that something more was given, but like a curtain opened, and you tasted momentarily the abyss-like divine nature of every moment of your life. And so then this starts path talk. What's the way of life in which I can be liberated from what hinders me from habitually abiding in the divinity of the immediacy of my life? And I get the feeling that people come to the retreat when they hear that it's in silence and the mystics, they've in some way been touched by that. Like, how do I deepen that? Or how do I be faithful to that? How do I understand it? How do I live by it? And that's my sense of it.
I'm picturing 14-year-old James with Merton's The Sign of Jonas. Do you recall having an experience in those young ages where you thought, this is that connection that I was looking for? What did that feel like or seem like to you? Was it different than expected?
For me, where it started is that because of the trauma that was going on, a lot of the arguments with my father, it was about Catholicism. They fought about all kinds of things. And so she would take us to Mass on Sunday, I'm the oldest of six, and she would ask us to pray to God to give us the strength to get through the things that happen when Daddy gets mad. That's how she would. And so I was lying in my bed at night, as maybe four, and I could hear my father screaming at my mother outside the door. And maybe earlier that day he had hit me, or I knew if tomorrow he wanted to, he'd do it again. And so I took up my mother's word, and I prayed to God to give me the strength. I was lying there in the dark. And the experience I had was that God heard my prayer, came to me in the dark, and in a moment I can't remember, merged with me. So when I woke up the next morning, the trauma still went on. But when I came out of that into the living room, it was different. Because my father, if he hit me, he thought he was hitting me. But he didn't know he was hitting that other me that other people could see. He didn't know the real me was secretly carried by God into a secret place he didn't know about. Later, when I became a psychologist, I learned that I was dissociating, that I borrowed the religious imagery of my mother to give meaning to dissociating, but that doesn't mean God didn't merge with me in the dark. So when I read Merton, I saw monasteries. Gosh, there's places you can actually go and live there all the time. Because it was like a flame flickering in the wind. It was very much in the heart of me. But I thought the monasteries are built. People can surrender themselves over to that.
I am so sorry for what you did go through. I'm also happy that you felt God reach out and carry you or lift you in some way, even though the situation didn't go away immediately.
Exactly. Me too. Changed my life, saved my life, yeah.
In the upcoming conference in Rome in June, with faith and science combined, what will you be speaking to these scientific folk about meditation and contemplation?
Yes. When Merton's Palace of Nowhere came out, and I started giving talks around the country, I was invited by a clinical psychologist to give a weekend retreat to his patients and former patients and colleagues. And he had read Merton's Palace of Nowhere, the book. And he was an evangelical Christian, but his parents were missionaries in India. And he would go to the ashrams, and he was very moved by the depth of the yogis that would teach. So when he read Merton's Palace, it was his first exposure to mystical Christianity. And at the end of the retreat, he said, if you would commit yourself to exploring the contribution that these mystical unitive states of consciousness make to the science of psychology, I'll see to it that you can have a doctorate in clinical psychology with family support as a gift, not alone. You just have to commit. So I took him up on it. I was living in Cleveland. I was a high school religion teacher. And I spent 5 years of full-time doctoral work, Fuller Theological Seminary, going to this high school. So when I became a psychologist, that's science. to the diagnosis, assessment, and treatment of psychological symptoms that embody suffering. Looking for evidence-based integrity of a response, and evidence means empirically measurable. I developed a thesis statement around how I experience the interplay of what is the depth dimension of the healing encounter, and how does these measurable variables open out upon the immeasurable depth of the person's own existence in their own life, and how is therapy a kind of a process that invites that? That's what I want to talk about.
When I hear about the whole idea that you would be talking about internalized trauma and how contemplative prayer can increase quality of life, we read of Jesus, for instance, in the New Testament, healing people in person, physical touch or the words. But if I get what you're saying, it's like being in the presence of God itself can be healing for mental, physical, emotional trauma.
Yeah, so here's the way I put it. See, if we think of the word trauma, the root of the word trauma means a wound or a source of suffering. Mm. So we might say that all of us are subject to traumas great and small that can and sometimes do occur in our life together. Small traumas are the slights and the insults, the abandonments, the accidents, the hurts. But the point is, the center holds. Big trauma is it gets so intense you disappear into the trauma, the psychic death.
And is that why it's trauma? Because it stays with you. It wasn't a one-time thing.
Yes, because if you survive the incest or the beating, whatever, you're so glad you survived, but not quite, because it got inside of you. Mm. And then a triggering event is anything in the present that resembles the original trauma. Your automatic nervous system, the axis of the brain, you'll re-experience the trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. Then as a clinician, that needs to be dealt with in its own right. That's the therapy. But sometimes we get this feeling that we're skimming over the surface of the depths of our own life. And our own woundedness is carrying us along as part of it. And we realize somewhere that we're suffering from depth deprivation. And we know of depth deprivation because you can single out certain moments that you tasted it. In the midst of nature, in the middle of the dark, in the arms of the beloved, telling a child a goodnight story, pause between two lines of a poem, it shimmered and shined. So you know it's there. So then the question is, that right in the midst of therapy, what are the ways where that depth dimension starts shining out of the therapy itself? In their tears? It's very close to AA, like having had a spiritual awakening. As I start looking at a phenomenological exploration. And then when that opens up and that shines out, to mirror it back to the person and bear witness to it. And then say, you know, that depth inside of you is always there. And together, you can learn to be more habitually stabilized in it as a place out of which to face the hurting places. And this is the tone of it.
I'm curious, because you've taught so many retreats, people come and you're not just teaching, but you're taking moments to have silent meditation or contemplative prayer. Do you find that people are looking beyond the mark? I've got to have this certain experience to show that I've done it right. What are you hoping people will experience as they sit silently?
Well, first of all, let's say the person's coming in to me in therapy. Mm. A lot of them come to me in therapy because they'd be on one of my silent retreats and they want that dimension in their therapy. Sometimes not. In therapy, I see where they are. What do they want? Why are they there? And I meet them where they are. So I'll give an example.
Yeah.
It's like a liturgy or a ritual. We'll both sit down, you'll talk, and I'll listen. At a certain point, I'll ask you a question. And it's a real question. I want to understand you better. And the question is such that you can't respond without pausing for a moment to listen to yourself. And in that moment, you're becoming more present to yourself, and it's already started. You don't say it. They're not ready yet, but it's already begun. So little by little, it forms an alliance this way of growth. And in that trusting alliance, the person goes through their work. So one of my theses is that when we risk sharing what hurts the most in the presence of someone who will not invade us or abandon us, we can be reparented in love. But there's another level to this, that in that process, there is the opening up of what Jesus called the pearl of great price. And what opens up within the person is a depth of presence that's abyss-like. They might start laughing or they might tear up. It's deeper than simply freedom from symptoms. Often they'll say something like this: something was given to me, and I'm so grateful for it. I matter. I didn't know that I mattered. Hmm. I have a value that cannot be calculated. There's a preciousness about me that came shining out through my woundedness. No one can take it away from me. And that's the spiritual dimension. See, I think that starts to put words to that dimension.
What a gift to be able to just be with someone and be the person that can be safe enough that you can... it's their own experience, but you've set the stage for it.
Therapy was a good fit for me. I felt so grateful for it. The unrelenting courage of the human spirit. I felt so honored by that process. Yeah.
In one of your podcast episodes for Turning to the Mystics, you were talking about, actually, I think it was pilgrimage, both actual two places, but also inner journey and pilgrimage. I just wrote down a mystical experience, and this is, I'm quoting you to you here, experiencing God's presence in your life. That is the mystical experience.
See, the question is, what's that mean? I'll give some examples for me, from Thomas Merton, but all the mystics. Mm. He says, the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. So there he's bearing witness to the already perfectly holy nature of what is. This dance. Mm. And then he says a stunning thing. He said, we don't need to go very far to catch echoes of that game and of that dancing. And he gives very simple examples. He says, you're out walking alone in the midst of nature, and you turn to see a flock of birds descending. And as if out of the corner of your eye, you catch something in their descent that's primordial, vast, and true. And then to use faith language, although the person might not explicitly say it in faith language, you know that somehow the presence of God is the infinity of their descent. And their descent is the incarnate immediacy of God. And God's the infinity of your awareness of their descent. And your awareness of their descent is the concrete immediacy of God. And that's the experience of God. Another one is, there are moments between two people. In moments of loving union with each other, they sense something within their love that's beyond what words can say. It has a boundaryless quality. And in faith, you say, God's the infinity. You're reading a child a goodnight story. You sense it in the presence of the child. You're in the presence of God. Mm. That's why they're so disarming. And then what I'm saying also then, in love lost, as painful as it is, if you just sit with it very quietly, you can sense something of God's sustaining presence guiding you through the loss. And when you come out the other side, you're grateful to get your balance back. Oh, it's so important to never forget what you learned in the dark. About fragility, about the delicacy of life, about grace. So that's the tone of it for me.
I think I've had that very experience that you mentioned when reading bedtime stories or making up bedtime stories with my children at night. And it seems that even if I thought, we have the longest bedtime ritual, we should cut this shorter, almost every time I ended up choosing to spend longer than even I had planned, just because there was this sense of magic and especially something timeless about everything else disappearing except our being together. And I've also felt that during times, a season of my life when I was giving myself a full half hour of meditation and a kind of a listening prayer throughout that season, I think I've had enough little glimpses or closed-eyed sense that there was something just out of my sight or out of my reach that was there and touching me and was so vast.
Yes, that's another insight too. When we have these moments, like when we're quickened, you get the feeling that you're awakened to that which was already. St. Augustine says, you made our hearts for thee, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. I was seeking you without and you were within. You get the feeling that there's an inner quickening of a divine oneness that was already unexplainably there. And it came shining through into your experience. But it didn't have to travel some distance to get to you. It was already closer to you than you are to yourself. And you were quickened by it. And then the question then is, having been quickened by it, how can I learn to be more habitually stabilized in that and share it with people, which is the path?
James, you're looking back from a perspective of decades. What do you know now about your understanding of God or God's presence and prayer that you didn't when you were first starting this journey?
I'd put it this way. I wouldn't say it's so much what I know now that I didn't know. Rather, I would put it that there's been an unexplainable deepening of the oneness that alone is ultimately real. Woven through the intimacy, the immediacy of every moment. So my wife, Maureen, she died of Alzheimer's right here in the living room in house hospice. Her ashes are on the table there. I sit next to the one I write every morning. So we were very close like this about this. She was a therapist also. And then when she died, I just sense like the eternality of ourself. Because we would spend a lot of time with what we're doing now, Maureen and I, 30 years. We met at this level that transcends the body, like the divinity of ourself. So now that I'm still in the body and she's no longer in the body, the oneness that we were transcending the body in the body is the oneness that's still there. In other words, Thomas Merton, he said, it's very helpful to realize that when we die, we don't go anywhere when we die. We don't orbit the earth a few times and take off, go to God. Scripture says, in God we live and move and have our being. We're living our life in the vast interiority of God. So all the death is presence of the dead are here, the angels are here. We're living in the vast interiority of God. In moments of love or moments of silence, we get a flash. And in deep meditative states, you can see the dead. That is, you can realize the deathless presence. It's one with the deathless presence of yourself in a sense of like contemplation. And so for me, I just think it's been unfolding deepening of that unexplainable immediacy.
I really love how, I don't know how long your wife, since she passed.
3 years ago.
But to still have a sense of connection, that's quite beautiful.
Yeah, it is. And it's eternal. And by the way, I'll be joining her soon enough. I'm not stuck here. You know what I'm trying to say? Because in eternity, there's no time.
You've spoken about awakening. You used that word, a quickening, awakening. When people get a glimpse of their spiritual eyes or hearts are open in some way to some new mystical experience. Over the decades that you've been teaching, when you first started, most people did belong to a particular tradition or claim a particular religion as, quote, their own or their spiritual home.
It's probably true.
It seems less so today, although people still have their same spiritual need and longing that it seems we were created with. Do you have to teach differently now than you did then?
No, because I teach this. See, Merton once said, a lot of Catholics are losing their faith and they're losing it in church because it's not teaching this. And so when I teach the mystics, I teach this unexplainable oneness. And one of the ways I put it, for example, like echoing the tradition, that ultimately speaking, just one thing is happening. The infinite presence of God is presencing itself, is pouring itself out whole and complete in and as the gift and the miracle of the intimate immediacy of our very presence, the presence of others and of all things and our communal nothingness without God. So I would start out a talk and say, well, let's clear that up. Like, what the hell does that mean? And you start walking through moments where they've glimpsed it. And now here's a simple example that I would give. I think as we go through our day, most things we notice in passing on the way to something else. But every so often, something catches our eye. So, for example, let's say you pause and you look at a tree. As you just quietly ponder it. And what you'll discover, something starts to happen, is you start becoming qualitatively more present. There's a kind of a deepening descent. It goes deeper, deeper. And poetically, we would say, it drops down into and opens out upon the bottomless abyss of God. It's welling up and given the infinity of itself in the immediacy of you there looking at the tree. And in that moment, you're a momentary mystic. But it's so subtle, we don't stay long enough for it to have its way with us.
It's nice that you have been swimming in these waters long enough that it's not like you had to invent something new to share. It's drawn from the experience. You've talked about writing in the mornings. You've talked about contemplative prayer, meditation. You've talked about being a therapist. What are the things that make you feel connected to the divine or experience joy?
Yes, I write 6 hours a day in the morning. Mm-hmm. I write all morning. And when sunset, I do 3 more hours. Mm. So I write every day for 6 to 9 hours a day. Right now I'm working on a book on the art of discernment.
you focused on lots of Christian mystics, and you mentioned Merton talking about Buddhists and karma and dharma in the Hindu tradition. And do you see this as a kind of a place where interfaith work can happen when people simply come together to study
this? Here's the way I put it. Merton writes about this in Zen and the Birds of Appetite, Mystics and Zen Masters. He says, people on this path, on this mystical path in different traditions, here's the Buddhist, here's the Hindu, here's the Hasidic Jew. He said, those who are on this deepening path we're talking about now, as they approach the all-encompassing center, they recognize each other. And he said, if they would speak out and bear witness to the oneness, religion could be a source of unity instead of divisiveness. He said, the world will not survive religion based on tribal consciousness. And we need to restore the ferment of this holiness, this oneness, and share it with people.
Many thanks to James Finley for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, Soraya Pearson, and James Sturdevant. Our post-production team includes DJ Cromarty, Gracie Davis, and Mark Hansen. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here, In Good Faith. There is power in stories. They inspire us. They help us see ways we might try doing things. And sometimes a story will even tell us not to go down that particular path. And it's nice to learn that from a story or a conversation before you experience it yourself. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here from the In Good Faith podcast. I love stories because what they teach me about people, about God, about politics, about everything. And I hope you will check out the brand new podcast, Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. There is so much to learn from the stories of these guests because they are people who found themselves in an uncomfortable moment. They could have just left the situation, written off the people they disagreed with, but instead they made something beautiful out of it. And you can learn how, and I know you'll like the stories. This is hosted by Julie Rose, the host of Top of Mind. She does a great job, and I know you'll love the guests and their stories. Check out Uncomfy.